welcome to the Messiantics Podcast, a podcast about all things Messianic Judaism. Each episode, we will be sharing our opinions as we tackle some of the biggest issues in Messianic Judaism. Now, here's your hosts, Rabbis Eric, David, Jonathan, and Toby. Hey guys, thanks for joining us again for another episode. We are excited to have Ibarz Uchkun back with us for a part two as we continue our conversation with him. And Ibarz, actually, I had a question that kind of came to mind while we were talking before. And you had mentioned early in the last episode about the reality that the kind of the goal was for the Jewish people to be a light to the nations, and this idea that the we should be reaching out to the nations and bringing the good news of Yeshua not just to our Jewish people but to the nations. And I think I can speak for both of our congregations here on the Gulf Coast that the idea of the one new man is very important to us, and even more so the reality that I believe fervently that the scripture says that the unique calling to the Jewish people is, in fact, what you said, to be a light to the nations, and that the unique calling of the nations is to reach the Jewish people, and that in that cyclical reality is kind of what makes Messianic Judaism, not only Messianic Judaism, but also successful at sharing the good news with both Jews and Gentiles alike. And so for me, like I look at the scripture and I see as a Jewish believer that my unique calling as a Jewish believer doesn't change just because I'm a believer in Yeshua. It's still to reach the nations. My heart is for my Jewish people to come to faith, but the divine ordinance given to me and to the Jewish people is to reach the nations, and likewise, the nations coming into Messianic Judaism, the nations coming into the body of Messiah as a whole, their unique purpose and calling is to reach the Jewish people. And so it kind of feeds off of each other and bounces back and forth to some degree. And so you had brought up that idea, that concept, and so being a Messianic Jewish rabbi who is not Jewish by birth, who did not grow up in Judaism or anything even remotely close to a believing life, and then coming to faith as an adult on your own and living within the context of Messianic Judaism for years, and now kind of going back to your roots to some degree and bringing the good news to Muslims, how do you see your function, your identity as a Messianic believer and one who is a Messianic rabbi, even if you're not leading in a congregation anymore, or at least currently, you know, who knows what God's got for you in the future. How do you see your role and function as a Messianic believer as it relates to being a light to the nations? I want to hear you kind of talk on that a little further.
Well, I think, you know, like, before I get off into these conversations of like, whoa, I'm like Paul, you know, whatever. You know, I think I was with Ari Waldman in Texas, mm-hmm. and you know, he gave me an opportunity to come and speak. I did the message during the service, and then I went and taught a class after. And the next day, we were participating in a day of prayer for where, you know, this was a big coordinated thing, and all of the nations were praying for Israel. And in the midst of that, you know, he got up. After he introduced me, I prayed, and then he got up and, like, singled me out. And there was, like, all kinds of, you know, different churches and stuff like that there. And the point he made was that, you know, I am a Messianic. I've always felt like I was sent out from Messianic Judaism as a Messianic to fulfill this unique and particular calling for myself. But how it's kind of shook out was I am actually going to the Jews first in every city, because the connections I have and my heritage spiritually is through Messianic Judaism. In this last, we were just in Chicago a couple of days ago, and I reached out to Jake Rosenberg, and he said, come on out. So he flew me out there, and while we were waiting for, you know, it to actually happen, God opened up all of these other doors for the rest of our team to do ministry in Chicago. So, and we were all there at the same time. We never saw each other. And we were about 45 minutes away from each other. I was at the Messianic Synagogue, and they were at a church that in Little India in Chicago. in a primarily Muslim neighborhood doing the same thing I was doing. My class was at 12 and theirs went 9 to 12. And they had all kinds of meetings and stuff like that. So the way it's played out for me in particular is I wound up like developing partnerships with churches. I reach out to the Messianic Synagogue first. It was Ari who said it. It's like, you know, he's going to the Jews first, right? Which I think is like proper in light of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Because, honestly, I think if the Jewish people are called to be who they're called to be, and Paul went to the synagogues first to express to them, you know, who Yeshua was, the 2.0 of that, now that we have, you know, Messianic congregations that are active and growing, my desire is to serve as kind of an activator in that calling, you know.
So let me ask a question real quick along this line. How would a local Messianic synagogue reach out to you to come and maybe present in their synagogue and help them with possible outreach to Muslims in their cities or their town? And is that something that you're open to doing? And secondary to that, do you have a website or something that people can go to if they maybe their synagogue isn't in a place or a position to have you come and speak, but they can find more information and maybe financially support what you're doing where you are in other places?
Our website is www.almida.org. Now, I know that that's going to be hard to spell. It's almaidah.org. And if you want to, you can send me an email at ibars@almaidah.org, almaidah.
And we'll put both of those addresses in the information for the podcast.
Yeah. And to answer your question, you know, we prefer to go to the city because the information is best transmitted. You know, anyone can just pop on a YouTube video, right? But the problem is that there are so many questions after that don't get answered that help, you know, the people, the intended audience to kind of move forward from that, right? Because I think everybody's had some experience with a Muslim at one point in their lives, and they're trying to apply what we're teaching to the particular Muslims that they're, you know, trying to reach. And I think the Q&As are invaluable. I think the ongoing relationships are invaluable. We don't desire to just come in and do our thing. We want to, you know, continually help whatever ministry reaches out to us to do that. And to come up with part two of what we teach is very strategy driven. Like, how can we help this body of faith, this local body of faith, reach out to Muslims around them? But that being said, you know, if we have to do it, you know, over Zoom or something like that, we will. And I think as far as financial support, I mean, I'm the development director for them now. I used to be the coordinator of Afghan outreach, and you know what's changed in that promotion as far as my salary? Nothing. I still have to raise it. So, there's a page on our website that's at www.almaidah.org /ibars that will take you to my giving page. And all you have to do is click on the link. It's a Subsplash giving page. I think many people who have experience with giving online to churches and Messianic synagogues have experience with that. And all you have to do is write IBARS, AYBARS, in the memo field, and it will go to me.
Perfect.
As far as support goes, you know, I mean, I just want to say to anyone who would consider supporting me, I'm honored that you would consider doing that, and I will make sure all of your support goes to exactly what you're trying to dedicate it to, which is reaching Muslims. I consider myself a hard worker, and I'm grateful for any support that you give. I'm going to do this regardless, but any support that you do, like, helps take care of me and helps take care of my family and helps ensure that I can keep going in ministry.
Right. You know, when we talk about why we would want to reach out to Muslims, it's important, or I share with people, it's important to know that the enemy, the adversary, Hasatan, has tried ever since the beginning of the creation story to destroy families, to divide families. And we have to remember that the Muslim people, the Arab people, the Islamic faith is one of those divisions from the family that we need to see restored, and not restored in being twisted or in a way of, like we talked about, Chrislam or a Messianic Islam or anything, but restored back to the faith of the Bible. And so when we look at people that are in Islam and following that faith, they need to be restored to the family. And just as if you had a wayward son or daughter and you wanted them to come back to faith and be restored to God, we should look at not just Muslims but all people. But in this discussion, and people say, well, Muslims hate us, or Muslims hate Jews, or what about this, what about that? That hatred is a deception brought about by the adversary to divide the family. And we should be doing everything we can to restore the family, which is one of the reasons that I think what you do, Ibarz, is so important in what you're doing. So if you want to share anything on that, you're welcome to jump in.
Well, particularly as a Messianic, right? Like, my background is Muslim. My relatives are all Muslims. I was raised by Muslims. My father, my mother, my aunts, my uncles, my cousins, all of my remaining relatives, all my relatives in Turkey are all Muslims. And I am the only one in my family, probably that I know of in, like, thousands of years, right? Because my people have been from that, like, area of southern Turkey for a long time, you know? And on my father's side as well, you know, whoever's left, they're all Muslims too, right? So for me personally, I felt like this, you know, love for Muslims that, honestly, the understanding of it had been that I had only felt that love for the Jewish people, you know, it's like kind of like a direct revelation from God. But then when I was watching them throw those babies, you know, over that barbed wire fence and people falling out of airplanes and understanding what was coming and how it was going to affect this next wave of Afghan refugees, it just kind of, my heart broke like an egg.
Right. And what I'm trying to say, and you're hitting it, is that while you have a love for the Muslim people because you have a Muslim background, people like myself who don't have a Muslim background or should and need to have a love for Muslim people because they're part of God's creation and they're part ultimately of the family that God is trying to reestablish. In the same way that it frustrates me a little when I hear my Messianic brothers talk about their only concern would be to see Jewish people come to faith.
Right, or specifically Ashkenazi Jews.
Right, or specifically leaving out the Sephardim and others, where I think that we need to broaden our desire, and that's to see all people come to repentance, and that includes people who don't understand Islam, don't understand how the thought patterns, the culture, all those things. We should still desire to see that family restoration done, and therefore, in whatever way we're able to, support the efforts to see Islam, which is the, unless something's changed, the fastest growing religion in the world right now, see a restoration of truth to reconnect that whole faith group to Abraham through faith so that they can become children of Abraham once again. So, and that's why I think what you're doing is so important and why we should really back up that, not only with our money, but with our prayers, so that you can accomplish your goal, which helps us then to accomplish our goal, which is to go into all the world and preach the good news to every creature. Even though we may not be able to personally go everywhere, we can support and help those that are going places we can't.
Right. So what happened to me in that moment, my heart broke, and what came out was a love for Muslims that I had never experienced before. And what I realized was this was God's love for Muslims. And I think what I want to, you know, kind of expand on in line with what you're saying is, it's more than just, it is a reconciliation between the sons of Abraham, right? It is, you know, part of the prophetic destiny of, you know, what I like to call the heritage of Ishmael, right? Like, these Muslims that have eventually become, you know, that may not genetically trace back to Ishmael, but look back to him as a figure, right? As a central figure in their religion. And understanding that, you know, they are also called to participate in the great multitude that, you know, sits at the end of time, right? Where, you know, it says in the book of Revelation that there was a great multitude worshiping before the throne, people from every tribe, tongue, and nation. And they're all sitting there, and they're all praising God. And what I feel like the Messianic community is uniquely positioned to be able to do, even more so than the Christian community, is to be able to be facilitators in that. Because I am with you, Eric. I am frustrated that Messianics who only want to reach Jewish people, or who are only hyper-focused on reaching a small segment of the Jewish people. I had a conversation with a Messianic rabbi who gives ministry in Kazakhstan, and this was early on in my faith, you know, and this particular Messianic rabbi was like going through, you know, like getting beaten up and all this other stuff. And I heard his testimony at conference. My sister-in-law is from Kazakhstan, and she was in Kazakhstan at the time, and he was going back there with my nephew. And I went and I had this conversation with him. I'm like, you know, you're going to Kazakhstan. Where are you going? He said, I'm going to Almaty, which is the council, the capital. And I said, that's, you know, incredible. Would you be willing to visit my sister-in-law and my, you know, her mom and my nephew there? Because I think it would be great if a Messianic rabbi went and visited them. And in my mind, you know, I'm picturing like the Book of Acts, right? Like, this is a great opportunity for a Messianic rabbi to meet, like, you know, local people and to share with them who he is and, you know, what he stands for. And he goes, yeah, that sounds great. Are they Jewish? And I said, no, they're Kazakhs, you know. And he said, I only go to Jews. And turned his back and walked away from me. So that had like a really formative effect and put some strong opinions in me about how I feel about this idea of, you know, and again, this is kind of like what I call being Jew-exclusive, right? It's yeah. Just this idea that you know, Gentiles are like this ancillary thing, and that we have to focus on reaching our people. And I can sympathize to one point, because I know that, you know, up until like the last 100 years or so, the Jewish people have been very under-evangelized. But I think you're missing the point if in the middle of God's prophetic movement that you're only saying, like, God's prophetic movement is limited to just these people. Because if that's what Peter had done, then God would have chosen somebody else to go to the Gentiles, right? He would have chosen somebody else to go to that house and preach. So, I think that, as you know, Messianics, like, again, it's just so important to be able to say, like, we need to look beyond just reaching the Jewish people, because God Himself is looking to reach to looking beyond that.
Right.
He wants all of us to be able to participate in this great thing that He has planned, where we will all be before Him at the end of time, you know, free of like these opinions that we have of who should be reached and when, and we'll be in the presence of God, and that's the outcome we should want for all humanity. You know, we don't want five people at that. You know, we don't want just Jews worshiping before the throne. Because that's not what it says.
Right.
So, Yeah, I feel like what we're doing is really important with the Almeida Initiative, and I feel like, you know, me being a Messianic adds a wrinkle to this Christian ministry that honestly they really welcomed. They were eager for it to, you know, kind of. James is a Christian, goes to a church, you know, in downtown Seattle. He's English, so everything he says is much more polished than that. Sounds much more polished.
Very British.
Yeah. And, you know, but we have a remarkable appreciation of each other's theology. Like, his theology is very close to Messianic theology. Mm. And the only places where I've had to step in and kind of offer some kind of Messianic perspective are things that are like eschatological, right? It's,
I got you.
It's only nine, 10 o'clock.
Hey, so Ivars, I want to press just a little further on something we just talked about, because I had this in my mind, and then Rabbi Eric started talking about, you know, not just Jews, but all the nations. Just, you know, bear with me, and I know you can relate to this. So I was 25 when I was called into Messianic Judaism. I came to know the Messiah in the Baptist church. And my first question as I began to attend a Messianic synagogue and began to realize that I don't just want to attend, I want like at the buffet, I want everything on my plate, you know, as much as possible, you know. And so I began to ask myself and the Lord the question, okay, where do I fit, because I'm not Jewish. Even my Christian friends and people in my life that were Christian, that, and when I mean Christian, we both had faith in the Messiah, but they went to church. And they would say to me this statement, even Christians would say this statement, when I would share with them what was happening in my life, they would say, it sounds like, based on what you're telling me, that you think Jewish people are better and that God likes them more and he loves them more. Is that what you're saying? And no, that's not what I was saying. But what's interesting is that they would ask me that question and I would walk away thinking, well, man, God, is that true, you know? Because, and you were touching on it, you said, you know, how non-Jews aren't just this ancillary people. And unfortunately, it's very unfortunate that I have sat in a seat where a rabbi behind a bima, a Messianic rabbi, has said things like, hey, look, you guys are grafted into this thing. And I'm like, oh, okay, so I'm in coach and you're in first class. So I'm a step kid and I should just be happy with salvation. So I guess I'm saying, so, and I imagine for someone who's Islamic with all the cultural dispute, the cultural conflict and all those things, if I'm putting myself, I guess, kind of playing devil's advocate, it's even a bigger obstacle for me, because how do you respond to someone and maybe you've even had somebody say that to you, like, what, so God likes Jewish people more? So what am I? So God just wants me, what, just in a seat? He just wants me in the crowd? You know, and I get the cheap seats, you know, and I think that Messianic rabbis haven't done a good, I think some Messianic rabbis have not done a good job, because I've sat in front of plenty that had a very beautiful, proper, biblical view of what the one new man is. And how do you share that with Muslims? Not only do they have to put faith in Messiah, but they have to understand, one, the unique calling that the Jewish people have as God's firstborn, but also understanding that you're not a second-class citizen, you know? Because I think that, like you said, I have some issues with the Messianic movement with how they communicate this, because they don't do it. I hate the, hey, look, you guys are grafted in. Yes, we are grafted in, but we're co-heirs. It's like, you know what I'm saying? It's
right. No, I understand. And I think if I understand your question correctly, the first part I want to address is just, like, as a Gentile being in the movement for a long time, the way that I personally was taught to not feel like a second-class citizen was in relationship with Messianic Jews who didn't feel that way. I mean, Jan Rosenberg was my rabbi, and he didn't feel like a second-class citizen. I learned, you know, about who God was and the love of God through a mentor who was a Messianic rabbi. who never looked at me that way. I did encounter that quite a bit, you know, particularly when it came in terms to being called to be a leader.
Oh, yeah.
Where, you know, people like, I mean, even to this day, right? Like, you made it up, you know? Like, you made the people on the outside, you made it up, and people on the inside, well, you're not Jewish, so you shouldn't be a rabbi. I think that even particularly, you know, I was fortunate. I mean, I guess God knew what he was doing when I got saved in a synagogue whose, you know, parent organization is more friendly to that than other messianic aspects of the messianic movement. So I learned that from people who really just loved God and loved people and understood that, you know, who they were. They were secure in their identity as messianics, and then also understood that, you know, there's a prophetic piece out there. And for me personally, me coming to faith as a, you know, I committed myself to being essentially a Muslim again, and hearing the name of Yeshua, you know, spoken to me over and over again. I mean, that's how he introduced himself to me. I was in a synagogue, and I was at Beth Yeshua in Philadelphia, and somebody invited me, and I heard David Chernoff preaching, and he said this line, that said, Saddam wants to destroy Tel Aviv, but Yeshua won't let him do that. So it's 97, and Saddam is threatening to launch Scuds back into Tel Aviv, and I was literally just like a heathen chasing after a girl who invited me to a church, you know? And staring at the floor thinking, well, you know what, I'm just wondering if we're going to go out to the diner after this. I remember asking myself, well, who's Yeshua? And it was like the lights came on, but they were just around me. It's dark in the room. And I felt what I now know to be the presence of God just draw so close to me and thick. And I didn't want to raise my head. Like, I was just staring at the carpet. I knew that I was no longer alone. This awesome power was in front of me. And he said, I'm Yeshua. So whoever has like questions about whether or not, you know, Gentiles are like on the heart of God and relevant, I would point you back to that moment where God took somebody who had just recommitted himself to Islam and decided that he was going to be a serious Muslim and going to go learn to teach others to be serious Muslims, that he stood in my way. And he orchestrated my steps to be in a messianic synagogue so that he could introduce himself to me through his Hebrew name. Hmm. Now, I think this obliterates all the arguments, right?
Absolutely.
Because the problem is that if God shared your singular heart towards just reaching Jews, then why am I here? Why do I exist? Right?
Yeah.
And then on top of that, let's add in the Muslim piece, okay? The idea that it's just me is preposterous. Because I know, and this is what I tell every messianic congregation that I go to, I got saved because I was sitting out there in the seats like you are, and God spoke to me there, where I was at, right?
Right.
And I know I'm not the only one. And I said that there are people who are just like me who God wants to reach in your specific neighborhoods, and he wants to lead them to a similar process of bringing them to faith. And whether it's by like a direct divine revelation or some other process, the point is that we as messianics have to be open to this.
Yep.
Right? I heard the gospel being preached by a Jewish man in a messianic Jewish synagogue surrounded by Jews. God put me there. And spoke to me. So it was their faithfulness to their calling that led to me having the opportunity to experience the Jewish Messiah and be introduced to him in that manner. So I think it's like, and I don't want to come off as too harsh, but I think it's kind of childish.
Honestly. Yeah. No.
I think it, and like maybe like a spiritual, it's spiritually immature to say that, you know, we're going to only focus on reaching the Jewish people. I think that the problem with that is God promised to give the Jewish people the wealth of the nations. What is the wealth of the nations? They're Gentiles.
Yeah, I think
I might not have a lot of money, but I have gifts and talents that God wants to put in your congregation that, you know, will ultimately serve to help and grow your congregations to reach other people, Jews and Gentiles. And just let me finish one part. As far as Muslims go, okay, in telling them this story, again, I mentioned earlier, Muslims have an earlier entry point where they believe that he is all of these things, you know. He's a prophet. He's coming back, you know. But the problem with Muslims is not whether or not they're first or second class citizens. The message is that God had a plan for Ishmael, and that God has a plan to bring the sons of Ishmael back, right? To reunite them with their father and their brother and bring them back into a place of, you know,
blessing.
So that's best reflected in Isaiah 19, where there are three nations that God refers to. One is Israel, the other one is Egypt, and the last one is Assyria. And he shares with them names like, you know, Israel, like my heritage, but also similar names. I have to look it up, but because I have six kids and they ate all my memory. but these names that he shares with Assyria and Israel and Egypt are names that he uses for Israel. So he's extending elements of the Abrahamic covenant to these nations, and the only way that he can do that is by those nations experiencing faith in Messiah, right? Because it says that he'll send a deliverer to Egypt in that chapter during Egypt's great day of trouble, and that he'll make a highway that will be a praise and a blessing to everyone on the face of the earth, right? Those are two Muslim nations. So we're not looking at second-class citizens in that passage. I mean, that's in the book of Isaiah. It's not in the book of Galatians or anything like that.
Yeah, he says, Egypt, my people, Assyria, my handiwork, Israel, my inheritance.
Right, right. So look at that passage, and you tell me that these nations now that are 100% Muslim, right?
Right.
If not, 99.999% pure, right?
Islam, oh, absolutely, right? Yeah.
Right, right. And, you know, Egypt we know, Israel we know, Assyria is yet undefined, but look at the area of the map, and that's southern Turkey, you know, most of Turkey, that's parts of Iran, parts of Iraq, Syria, Jordan, right? Like, there are these areas that he's referring to that are going to be places where his spirit will dwell, and in not only just dwell, but dwell in partnership with Israel. So I think theologically speaking, to ignore that is to miss a huge blessing and a part of the calling of the Jewish people, particularly as it relates to Israel.
That's awesome. No, I fully agree with that, you know, and I just want to add, never once, just on a personal note, you know, never once in all my years in Messianic Judaism has God, this is, everything I've shared with you has always been things I've heard from others. God has never once with his Holy Spirit convicted me or given me any kind of limits about how far I can go with him in my personal walk with him, you know.
So I mean, when I felt the call in the ministry, I was 1 week old in the Lord. I immediately at the end of that first week understood that I was called to be in leadership in a congregation. If not to lead a congregation, I wanted to get married and I wanted to have kids. And he made me wait 10 years to get married, right? And 12 years to have kids. And then eventually I became the assistant rabbi. I've never been a senior rabbi, but, you know, I think all of you guys know that I could totally do that if I was called, if it was something that what God wanted me to do.
Absolutely.
I didn't view my time at Restoration as being like an underling or anything like that. We were peers, you know.
Cool.
I kind of, you know, I've understood over time that the idea, the ceiling that was put, you know, in place was ceilings that were put there by people and not at all how God wanted it. And listen, we're in an imperfect movement with imperfect people. We have flawed people all over our movement. I'm a flawed person, right?
Yeah.
So eventually, as we work together as Jews and Gentiles, as, you know, Muslim background believers and Messianics, we're going to work towards this point in this future, because the great line in that passage, it says, in that day, when talking about Israel, Egypt, and Syria, the foundations of in that day are in the past, and they refer the future, but in the present, we are called to work towards that in that day, right? Like, we are going towards that time in that day, and it's our responsibility as believers to walk in the understanding that that in that day is coming, and that we need to put our hearts and our minds, you know, our, it's the Beahatha, right? All of your heart, all of your soul, and all of your strength into loving God and taking those steps towards that day. And if we truly love God, then, you know, it's not just like receiving the love, it's understanding that we need to position ourselves to serve him and to give that love out.
So let me ask you a question for our listeners' sake. What events or things do you have upcoming that they can be praying for, maybe involved in if they're local, or if they're not local, maybe even support you in accomplishing?
Well, personally speaking, I'm speaking at a big church around here. It's called Mill Creek Foursquare here in the Seattle area. And the pastor there is a great guy. His name is Pastor Chris Manginelli. And he asked me to come and share my testimony. Like, I've done like 400 people, 500 people. This is a really big church, so I'm feeling I'll be a little nervous. But, you know, I love Chris and, you know, just prayer for that and, you know, to be able to make some like good connections and get, you know, people to support the ministry would be great. As far as the things that it would be, events wise, we send out a newsletter. So we keep people up to date on things that we're hosting. For instance, we had a post 4th of July barbecue, you know, where we invited Muslims and non-Muslims to kind of come together in the Seattle area. Again, this is a process we're seeking to replicate in other cities. So I expect here in the next year that, like, for instance, in Tampa and Phoenix, we'll be going, we're partnering with hopefully Messianic synagogues, but also churches in those areas, and, you know, laying the groundwork for organizations to host their own events. One thing that we do every year at Seattle around Ramadan is we host dinners. So we usually have like 3 or 4 at the beginning and 3 or 4 at the end. We host them in different areas around the Puget Sound. But if you really want to be a part of our ministry and understand, you know, our voice, right, like what we believe and the things that we're trying to communicate to the Islamic world, the best place to engage us is on YouTube. So the Almeida Initiative has its own YouTube channel, and I'm pretty sure these guys will link to it in the description. But that's where, like, you know, we put our podcast out. The Almeida Initiative podcast is a podcast that's directed towards Muslims. So what we'll do is we'll have James, our director, and he will interview right about some issue going on in the Muslim world. We recently had a woman in Zahala Farmas on, and she was the only female Peace Prize, and she's also the only the only Afghan female nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize. She's also the only woman to ever bike across Afghanistan. Wow. And she had to flee, you know, so we have conversations like that with her, and, you know, what it's like living in Afghanistan, and how she got out of Afghanistan is another one. That woman I talked about earlier, the First Lady of ISIS, we have several long conversations with her in that podcast. The other podcast we just recently started was called Christ in the Caliphate. And Christ in the Caliphate is just a Christian response to issues in the Muslim world. That could be anything from the World Cup in Qatar, to like Marvel put out a series called Miss Marvel, right? So we're going to do a season one review of Miss Marvel soon.
Any excuse for you to deal with some sort of comic book character?
Yeah.
I thought it was not a mistake. Like, I think I know he did it intentionally, where he called it the Online Initiative. I know he did it intentionally. James is a lot of fun. The other thing we do is a series called Ask Almeida, which is questions that Muslims ask us. So they send us questions about, like, why don't Christian women wear the hijab? Why don't Christians have multiple wives, right? So we have just a lot of material on our YouTube channel that just reflects all of those things, right? Yeah, the YouTube channel is the best place, right, to hear, to kind of get involved in the Almeida ethos. And also to see what we're doing. And from there, again, you can send an email to info@almeida.org, and we will keep you appraised of our events and the things that we do. I think we are hopefully coming to a city near you soon.
So let me ask you one question as we get ready to draw to a close. I wanted to ask you to talk. You and I have been friends for a number of years now, and we've had quite a few conversations over the years. And one of the things that you were telling me about as you were just getting plugged in with Almeida was that, you know, at least for the majority of your believing life, there's been, I don't know how strong of a word to use, but kind of an avoidance of all things connected to the Islamic world. And that in the past couple of years, there's been like a reignition of a love for the Islamic people as a whole, or for the adherents of Islam as a whole. And that was a kind of a big driving factor to you getting plugged in with Almeida and transitioning from serving in the Messianic Synagogue to serving with this particular ministry. And so I just want you to, if you're willing to talk a little bit about kind of that experience from coming to faith in Yeshua and the kind of dichotomy and an avoidance of kind of all things Islam to where you are now with this love and passion coming back around again, kind of seeing, I guess is the best way I could describe it, is God's eyes for his creation.
So when I got saved, it wasn't just that I got saved to my parents. It was that I did it with them. There was a lot of help. Like, you know, nobody, like, threatened to kill me or anything like that. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't have to go through that. My dad was heartbroken that I had done this thing. My mom was heartbroken. And they were angry, you know? And I didn't handle it the greatest because I made the mistake that a lot of, like, people who are super zealous right in the beginning do. They say stuff like, well, I'm really excited. Here's this person. His name's Yeshua. I met him, right? And then if you don't accept him, you're going to go to hell. So, you know, I had to move out. And I lived away from them for about 2.5 years. Unbeknownst to me, my rabbi and my dad had a conversation where they both kind of mutually conspired to get me to move back in with my dad. And during that time, I repaired my relationship with him, but there were two things we really couldn't talk about. We couldn't talk about religion or politics. I would say that I wasn't really, like, shunning all things Islam, but I was really focused on being where God wanted me to be. And, you know, everyone has their trauma, right? So some of my trauma came from that place of being, raised in a Muslim house. And I was, you know, seeking healing at that time, and I was trying to really grow as a disciple. And I was really excited about the things that were put in front of me. And again, I felt called to leadership. So I was leading right where I was at. And that takes a lot of wherewithal, as you all know. But it wasn't until after I got out of the Turkish military. So as a Turkish citizen, you have to serve 2 years in the Turkish military. and it's mandatory, and you don't really get out of it until like you're like 45 years old. So I had back surgery, and I had to go to Turkey, and I had to prove to them that I wasn't fit to serve. And honestly, it was after that when the door opened back up to Turkey, where I started visiting my mom often and spending more time in country and reconnecting with my relatives, that, you know, it just started to slowly be something that I thought it was dead, but it was coming back to life. And then slowly but surely, you know, the more and more I had children, my mom like let her walls down. My father passed away, but we were all on good terms when he passed away. My mother has been drawn towards her grandchildren. I'm the only one with lots of grandchildren. Like, I have one other brother who has a grandchild, but, you know, she hadn't seen him in a long time until recently. So we FaceTime her and we talk and all of these other things. And I'm taking my two sons there in November, you know? So again, you know, this kind of thing has awoken over time. But what happened with the fall of Kabul added a ministerial kick to it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It was like, this can't just be, okay, you know, I was born in Turkey and I was raised Muslim. It's like, no, this is a part of your story and God wants to highlight it and bring it to the forefront, as opposed to it being an ancillary thing. And that's when I got a bigger appreciation for how God had guided my steps, you know. Not just before I became a believer, right before I became a believer from birth. You know, he didn't want my refugee father to stay in Afghanistan. He moved him to Turkey where he could meet my mom. He didn't want me to stay in Turkey. He moved us to America where I would be in a position to accept him, where we would all be in a position to accept him. I think I was the one who did, you know. So, yeah. And ministry-wise, how that's translated is, I love working with the Almighty Initiative. I miss going to a Messianic synagogue every week. But I understand that for this season, that the calling that God has put on my life as far as, you know, reaching Muslims and being who I am in this kind of uncomfortable space between the church and Islam, and, you know, Messianic synagogues and Christianity as a whole, and being in a unique position to be able to kind of reconcile people to all of those viewpoints, right, under the banner of Yeshua, and pointing them all to Yeshua as, you know, the one who wants to bring people together under his banner, right, is something that's not lost on me. And I'm trying really hard to walk in that. I'm trying really hard to advance the good news from the perspective of not just everywhere where I've come, but where I believe we'll go.
Awesome.
I just want to remind everybody that you're welcome to go to the website that we have listed in the description to find out more. Visit their YouTube channel. And if you feel led to support this initiative, that would be a great place to place your resources.
So with that said, Ibars, we thank you for investing a little time with us today and for sharing your heart for Almaida and what the Lord is doing through that ministry, through you within that ministry. And we definitely pray for continued blessing, success in that. And thank you for being willing to serve as what I texted you earlier, jokingly, as a Messianic Shaliach to the Islamic world. So we appreciate your heart, and hopefully we'll have you back on again in the future.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, guys. Great to talk to you all.
Thank you for listening to the Messiantics Podcast. Make sure to subscribe so you can be notified every time we drop a new episode. And be sure to follow and interact with us on social media at Messiantics Podcast.